I'm your brother Fire Mary Diesel Ogaya, and welcome to the Class War Battlefield Podcast. When I started this show in 2011, my goal was to inform. Obviously, the show has evolved, a lot of new topics, a lot of new thoughts, taking on metaphysics, some spirituality, hitting you with all types of things that you may have never heard of, and some that you have. It's always lively. But now I'm coming to you to ask you to help me prolong this podcast. For years, I have been producing this podcast for free on your behalf. I am now coming to you to ask you to support this work. $2, $5, $10, $20, $50, whatever you can do, please do.
And now, the definition.
When the world lost its mind, when common sense suddenly became an uncommon virtue, Florida was a refuge of sanity, a citadel of freedom for our fellow Americans and even for people around the world.
Ron DeSantis has decided to put his people first.
Ron DeSantis taking a lot of heat over it, but he's not backing down.
Florida's success has been made more difficult by the floundering federal establishment in Washington, D.C., an inflationary spending binge that has left our nation weaker and our citizens poor. It has enacted pandemic restrictions and mandates. It has recklessly facilitated open borders. It has imposed an energy policy that has crippled our nation's domestic production. This has caused many to be pessimistic about the country's future. Some even say that failure is inevitable. Florida is proof positive that we, the people, are not destined for failure.
DeSantis wins. He has made a promise, and he's making good on the promise.
Florida is leading the nation. We are the nation's fastest growing state. We rank number one in education freedom. We are number one in economic freedom. Florida also ranks number one in public higher education. This is a record we can all be proud of.
That's why the left hates Governor DeSantis, because he's a winner. That's what the guy does, he wins.
Decline is a choice. Success is attainable. And freedom is worth fighting for.
I mean, age is almost a fault. Almost a sin, you see. And youth is a virtue, you know, which is, if middle-aged people feel that way, then they can't blame young people for contemning them and wanting to stay young. I mean, if young people say that middle-aged people are dressing absurdly, trying to imitate their youngers, are using young slang, and using facial creams and hair restorers, and doing all these undignified things to keep away the ravages of time, if they see that middle-aged people themselves fear and despise death or aging, then why should they have any respect for old people?
In the United States, 10% of the population is over the age of 65. Since the turn of the century, that proportion has doubled, and by the year 2000, will increase even more. Aging has come of age. It is now considered one of America's pervasive social problems. What is problematic is not so much whether you will get old, but where you have chosen to do it.
The old person doesn't really have much of a role in America. I would hardly call it a role, actually. Certainly the old concept of old people being wise and prudent and the counselors, the feeling that runs all through the Bible, through classical literature in Greece and Rome, through the Middle Ages, began to dwindle, I think, with the Industrial Revolution, diminished enormously in the Victorian Age, and I think in modern technological 20th century society, the old person is more of a nuisance than anything else, really.
It has been noted that the two groups historically most concerned with the aged are poets and politicians, neither of whom have done anything to appreciably help them. That may still be true for poets, but the men in the art of the possible are at least going through the motions. They'd be nuts not to.
certain there will be about 8.5 million more by the year 2000, and a number of aged will double to 40 million by the year 2020. And these numbers, incidentally, unlike many other types of demographic projections, are more in the nature of actual predictions. Because everyone who will be 65 and over to the year 2020 is already born. And unless there's some catastrophe, such as a thermonuclear war, they're going to be here.
The aged, as a group, are not unlike other age groups. They prefer independence to dependence, enjoy contact with other age groups, but not as much as is supposed, consider themselves comparatively healthy, and rarely see themselves as old. Since most of them, particularly those over 75, were socialized in an era imbued with the Protestant ethic, they are unalterably opposed to charity. That is somewhat unfortunate, since a third of them are considered poor, and an additional 15% near poverty. If you've ever contemplated the relative imperfections of the welfare bums, you'd be interested in the Amish. They are thoroughly capitalistic, sober, pious, and very can-do. The personification of the American way. They refuse all governmental assistance, and with old order Amish, even decline Social Security. If an Amish man falls on hard times, the community simply closes round and helps. Unfortunately, there are some drawbacks to the Amish style. For example, they never rip off phony insurance claims, since they don't believe in buying insurance. They are opposed to suing each other, and what's worse, they don't even watch TV. It's clearly an inappropriate lifestyle for the average Americano. There had to be a better way, and we found it in the 30s.
During the Depression 1930s, for example, about a fourth of our total workforce was unemployed with a cessation of income flow. It wasn't because they were lazy bums. It was because our economy had simply ground into a dead halt.
Thousands of unemployed men and women today are struggling to keep their homes and families together. Won't you help them by sharing your better fortune with them? Remember, sharing does not hurt like suffering.
I remember vividly when we introduced Social Security in 33, all the conservative and reactionary groups were screaming we're on the road to communism, that everybody would wear a dog tag with a number on it, that people would lose their identity and their autonomy, and it was the first step toward dictatorship. All that absolute ludicrous nonsense. We still don't have an adequate Social Security system, adequate medical system in this country. Of course, society has to take care of old people. Their families aren't going to do it. They should do it. They should, maybe you should help, but they're not going to. Well, but you see, if you have a capitalistic society that promotes individualism, you can't turn around and then expect them to be collectivistic. You can't then say to families, well, it's your obligation to take care of these people, you know. They say, it's my obligation to take care of me.
To my way of thinking, anyone with property, no matter what age, regardless, no matter what age, with property of a value of $35,000 and above, does not need to have other citizens pay out of their pockets for his support.
I don't like these hard and fast black and white categories. After all, public school system is socialism. Post office has been socialism. I mean, you know, and my God, we've got socialism at the top. All the big corporations practice socialism. They're given all kinds of welfare benefits by government, cost-plus contracts, fast depreciations. I mean, there's just enormous socialism at the very top level of our economy. The only place they don't want it is at the bottom where they need it the most.
Today, the computers spin out 30 million Social Security checks a month. For the retiree, Social Security is theoretically a fairly solid insurance policy. Unfortunately, that is not what it is. It is a tax. By calling it insurance, the administration was able to raise the premiums by $7 billion in 1972 and avoid a revolt. If you earn $12,000 a year, 8% of your paycheck goes into Social Security. But if your salary is $40,000, less than 2% is taken. It is a pay-as-you-go proposition, with the present workforce supporting the retired population. But then it was never intended to be a sole source of income. Apparently, the assumption with Social Security was that Yankee genius would make up the difference. It hasn't worked out that way for everyone. Retirement is an American invention and is a way not of time, but of life. It is necessary, if for no other reason, to keep the economy moving by keeping the workers in it moving. But for the record, at 65, you're hardly over the hill. In fact, nothing much happens at that age. Studies indicate that learning capabilities do not drastically drop off, and absenteeism actually lessens. For many American workers today, retirement is not the mental catastrophe it was cracked up to be.
I was glad to go, but yet it was felt kind of bad to think, well, you're not going to be down there with your friends every day and talking to them and things, you know. I just never figured myself as getting old. I don't know. Now, when my father was 40 years old, I remember back when I was a kid, I thought he was an old man. But I don't figure that I'm old. Getting old don't worry me a bit. If I can go with my shoes on, I'll be tickled to death. But the thing that scares the missus and I both is you run into a long spell of sickness after you retire. That can just knock the devil out of money and you and everything else.
The proportion of widows over 75 has risen dramatically, over 30% in the last 10 years. By 2000, it is projected that in America there will be 148 women over 65 for every man. With the average age of widowhood at 56, many women in the United States are facing more than 20 mateless years. That's a long time to crochet.
They're not wanted. They're not needed. They were needed in the past, too. I mean, it wasn't simply sentimentality. It was that they could do things. There weren't any prepared foods, and there weren't any washers and dryers, and they did the canning, and they did the sewing and the dirty work, and often took care of the grandchildren. And with the growth of technological society, they became very dispensable, and we dispensed with them.
This will be hard to swallow. In spite of the fact that you live in a country that gives you shampoo with vitamin E and orange-flavored shaving cream, you are going to age and eventually die. Benjamin Gompertz, a 19th century insurance man, figured out that your chances of dying double every 8 years. But don't worry. Those chances do not necessarily increase in proportion to the amount of function lost. In English, that means that you'll be around for a while, even if you're falling apart from birth.
I'm now nearing the end of my journey. I hope I still have some services to render. However that may be, and whatever may befall, I am sure I shall never forget the emotion of this day.
Incidentally, it was Winston Churchill who said that people who abstain from smoking and drinking don't live twice as long. It just seems that way.
Old people have a responsibility to become interesting as they grow older. I think that as we get more like a prune on the outside, we have to get more like a peach on the inside. And we do get ugly when we get old. You know, we sag and we get wrinkles and we get bent and we're unattractive. Even more reason for us to be merry, to be interesting, to be interested, not when children or family come around to whine, complain, give supererogatory advice. I mean, old people tend to be drags that way. And then they wonder why their children or families don't come around. So there's a dual responsibility. But you see, there again, the American culture does not equip people to grow and develop in maturity as they get older. It narcoticizes them with television and with junk and with nonsense and trivia so that their minds don't get richer, their spirits don't get broader. They get very dull and shallow. That's why many men, when they retire and leave their jobs, die. A sad commentary, because that's when they're supposed to do their most interesting living. But they have become functions of people. All they're really interested in is a job, and on weekend, parking their butts in front of the TV and watching sports for 12 hours, you see. So when the job is over, and when their eyes are failing and their health is failing, their shells are empty shells. So I think our culture also has a responsibility. You know, Socrates was asked what the meaning of life was, and he said it was practice in dying, which is really a rather good definition, I think. All life, in a sense, is practice in dying. It's learning how to die well. Learning how to become an age, many of the things you can't become when you're young, and to expand and to be who you ought to be, to drop your pretenses, to drop your need for status, to drop your bigotries, to become as full a person as you can.
The West is in decline. It's in decline for quite a while. With the biggest crisis of the 21st century approaching, we could see the final battle of the West against an emerging Asia and Asia Minor. In this report, I will explain why not only the Pax Americana will end, but the West's dominating role in the world as a whole. Welcome to Dark New World. For centuries, Europe was the center of the world. After World War II, the United States of America took over the leading role, the most dominant force in the world. Most of the trade, industrialized economic power and science was located here. For the past 100 years, with the exception of the Soviet Union, there was no power that could compete with the West. But this has changed. After the fall of the Soviet Union, the US enjoyed the status of the only world superpower. But while America was involved fighting wars in the Middle East, another threat emerged: China. Asia has caught up as a whole. The center of innovation and advancement is not in Europe or the US today. It is the Asian tigers that are dominating the tech sector. Western liberal democracies held up the importance of free speech and political discourse for a very long time. But in the past years, something changed. People wake up in America and cannot recognize the country anymore in which they grew up. People in Europe hear voices that are pushing for authoritarian politicians and parties. People are divided and stop debating with each other. It seems like the pressure on Western societies is increasing with every minute. And then there's the third world. War-torn, abused and underdeveloped. It looks into the direction of the West with doubt, fear and paranoia. But slowly, they too have a higher and higher standard of living. And with China, they have a new potential partner for trade. Let's look into the internal problems first. Because right there, we will find the biggest threats that could tear down Western society faster than any army in the world. The political economist Benjamin Friedman once compared modern Western society to a stable bicycle whose wheels are kept spinning by economic growth. Should that forward-propelling motion slow or cease, the pillars that define our society – democracy, individual liberties, social tolerance and more – would begin to teeter. Our world would become an increasingly ugly place. One defined by a scramble over limited resources and a rejection of anyone outside of our immediate group. Should we find no way to get the wheels back in motion, we'd eventually face total societal collapse. Such collapses have occurred many times in human history. And no civilization, no matter how seemingly great, is immune to the vulnerabilities that may lead to a society to its end. Regardless of how well things are going in the present moment, the situation can always change. Putting aside species-ending events like an asteroid strike, nuclear winter, or a deadly pandemic, history tells us it's usually a plethora of factors that contribute to collapse. One of which is the economic decline in standard of living we have in the West. For decades, the standard of living is silently declining, especially in America, where most jobs generated enough income for a house and two cars back in the 50s. Today, most young Americans can only dream of owning a home. One sign is the romanticized van life trend you can see on social media or YouTube. The economic conditions in the US are so bad that many people have to live in a car because rent is too high for most jobs. For decades, the United States of America were the role economic model and stood for prosperity for half of the globe. But these times have passed. 2008 was the last nail in the coffin of the American dream. Unfortunately, this leads us to the social conflict that is brewing in the US. The wealthier a nation is, the more tolerant its society will be. If there are hopes for massive gains for everyone, it's easier to accept and be more tolerant to other groups. But when wealth is disappearing, so is the tolerance. From religion, race, to political views, everything can cause massive cracks to rip apart the society. And the US is in a very bad state in the moment. The important question is, for how long can the US endure those conditions before heading into an escalation of the conflict? If things don't turn around rapidly in the next years, we could see an implosion of the society in the US, and paired with all the small arms in the country, a possibility of civil war. While this sounds like the plot for a disaster movie, so does any summary of the last 2 years. A poll demonstrates that negative partisanship and other forms of extreme political polarization now appear to be permanent features of American political life. Among Republicans, 52% believe it's likely that there will be a civil war in the United States in their lifetime. The proportion among Democrats is only slightly smaller, at 46%, while 50% of independents share that view. While 50% of respondents were willing to rule out using violence or taking up arms against the government to protect the country from radical extremists, 26% of those who participated said that political violence could sometimes be justified. Fact is, the American people understand that their democracy and their society are in deep trouble, but they do not agree on who or what is the cause of the problem and do not share a common understanding of basic facts. To make matters worse, there is a kind of sinister synergy between Americans' democracy crisis and other serious problems facing the country, which risks creating a state of collective paralysis. But the world outside the West is not stopping. On a global scale, the West will probably lose the position of power to Asia. The West is currently buffeted by the tides of isolationism and fragmentation, while in the East, a network of relationships takes shape along the ancient trade routes. The decisions being made in today's world that really matter are not being made in Washington, London and Paris, but Beijing and Moscow. One reason of the optimism across the heart of Asia is the immense natural resources of the region. British Petroleum estimates that the Middle East, Russia and Central Asia account for almost 70% of total global proven oil reserves and nearly 65% of proven natural gas reserves, without including Turkmenistan. Then there's also plenty of rare elements like silicon, dysprosium and terbium. The war in Ukraine shows that direct access to resources is paramount in times of conflict. While Russia has a weak economy at the moment, it does have access to vast resources on its lands. Something that could be the key to survival. On the other hand, Europe is getting dragged down to earth, facing the biggest energy crisis in its history. Europeans celebrated a concept called soft power, which involves the resort to dialogue, mediation and other strategies that avoid military action. But the embracing of soft power was simply a way to evade reality. And soon the Europeans discovered that soft power was soft and that they needed hard power to shape events. The question about the future is not whether it will be defined by competition, because it will be, but whether competition will be managed. EU members must realize that in our complex and conflictual world, size matters, and that on their own, even the largest EU countries are just small fish in a big pond inhabited by whales like the United States, China and Russia. Only together can the EU members protect and promote their interests and values on the world stage. Especially China will try to shape the world after their bidding. China and Russia are currently in a difficult relationship with the United States, following the imposition of duties on China and sanctions on Russia. For the first time, the two great powers are considered competitors and rivals. In the 2017 and 2018 US strategy paper series, America's decline is impossible to disentangle from China's rise. So it's natural that the rapid climb of the Middle Kingdom back to its historic global primacy dominates discussion of the civilization state. Under Xi's rule, China has penetrated the Western consciousness, as Xi believes that a civilization carries on its back the soul of a country or nation. China is now the only country in the world which has amalgamated the world's longest continuous civilization with a huge modern state. This has allowed China's traditions to develop and adapt in virtually all branches of human knowledge and practices, such as political governance, economics, education, art, music, literature, architecture, military, sports, food and medicine. Unlike the ever-changing West, constantly searching after progress and reordering its societies to suit the intellectual fashions of the moment, China draws on its ancient traditions and wisdom, and its return to preeminence is the natural result. With each day passing, the West looks weaker and weaker, while the competition is getting stronger. Everything is pointing towards conflict between East and West. And this time, it will not look good for the West. On the other hand, Western societies may not meet with a violent, dramatic end. In some cases, civilizations simply fade out of existence, becoming the stuff of history not with a bang, but a whimper. The British Empire has been on this path since 1918, and other Western nations might go this route as well. As time passes, they will become increasingly inconsequential and, in response to the problems driving their slow fade-out, will also starkly depart from their values they hold dear today. Western nations are not going to collapse, but the smooth operation and friendly nature of Western society will disappear, because inequity is going to explode. The cycle of civilization has happened before and will happen again. And as the old saying goes, history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. What is unique this time around is that the span of Western civilization is global, reaching into all corners of the world, engendering major stress on Earth's planetary boundaries. One conclusion made here is that in the end, humanity will survive this transition, but only in smaller numbers, with a circumscribed view of human society, hemmed in by permanent ecosystemic damage to Earth's planetary systems.
In previous videos, we talk about GDP as the market value of final goods and services produced in a country in a given time period, let's say in a given year. And we gave the example of producing jeans, where maybe the farmer helps produce the cotton, and then the thread maker takes that cotton and makes thread, and then the fabric maker takes the thread and makes fabric, and then the jean maker takes the fabric and produces jeans. And so, and then the market value of those jeans was $50. And so, assuming all of this happened in 1 year, in the time period that we're measuring GDP for, then we would just count the $50 if we're looking at the final market value or the market value of final goods and services. You would say the GDP, for at least for this component of the GDP from these jeans, is $50. But I do want to clarify that there are multiple ways that you can measure GDP, and you could even think about it from a value-added approach. But the key idea is, no matter how you measure it, you should get to the same value. So let's think about the various actors here and what their value add was. So first, let's think about the farmer right over here. So the farmer's value add is what? Well, before you just had some dirt and things, and so maybe you could say that the market value was zero, and then he's able to produce something, or she's able to produce something that now has a market value of $10. So their value add is $10. Now, from there, the cotton goes to the thread maker. The thread maker, they take the $10 cotton and are able to produce $20 worth of thread. What is their value add? Well, they took something worth $10 and they were able to do something to it to make it work worth $20. So their value add is now another $10. And then from there, it goes to the fabric maker. And I think you see where this is going. And their value add is what? Well, they take something worth $20 and they were able to create it. They're able to turn it into something that has a market value of $30. So their value add is also $10. And then last but not least, you have the jean company. I'll call them the jean producer. They take something that has a market value of $30 and they're able to sell it for $50. So their value add, if you take something from $30 and you make it worth $50, then you've added $20 of value. And so the value added approach to GDP will just sum up these value adds. So this is going to be this $10 from the farmer, plus $10 from the thread maker, plus $10 from the fabric maker, plus $20 from the jean maker. And what will that all add up to? Well, that's all going to add up to 10 plus 10 is 20, plus 10 is 30, plus 20 is $50. And lucky for us, that is added up to the same amount as we had before, where we just looked at the market value of the final goods and services. Now, one benefit of the value-added approach is that real supply chains are quite complex, and things might be going from one country to another. They might, as we've talked about in another video, the year might end right over here. And so when something is made in China and there's value add in China, but then it's shipped to the US and some value add is placed on it, and then it's shipped back to China or Mexico, You have to be careful to only count the value add in the country for which you are measuring the GDP. So that's one useful way of, or one useful reason, or one way in which the value added approach might be useful. The key idea, though, is that you're getting to the same value. You should get to the same value as the market value of the final goods and services produced in a given time period.
Why do they call it wage inflation, but they never call it profit inflation? I mean, the stock market has, what, doubled or tripled in that time? That money hasn't come down to normal people. Is it just that we're just very comfortable with that as the status quo?
Yeah, I think we have to think about the idea that there's not a perfect economy, but there is an economy.
What?
Right.
Sir?
Right. But there are a series of choices that we make, and they have results. And there's a real trade-off between what's good for capital and what's good for labor. You could argue over the course of...
And when does the what's good for labor part kick in?
Yeah, I think that's the real difficulty, is that the decisions we do make over and over again tend to be better for capital than they are for working people. When we talk about raising interest rates, whether that's needed or not, we know that there are downside impacts. The downside impacts is that economic growth is reduced. People lose their jobs. Those people who lose their jobs are at the lower end of the economic spectrum. So there are a lot of challenges and risks involved with the decisions we've made.
The catch here is, if you don't raise interest rates when you need to, then inflation goes up and everybody wants higher interest rates for mortgages and everything because they want to be compensated for inflation.
Here's what the workers have suffered. Automation has taken their jobs. Globalization has taken their jobs. Regulations have been removed. Union power has dissolved. So it's been one erosion after another of their power. They finally get a little bit of a foothold, and immediately the Fed says, we got to put a stop to this.
Yeah, I mean, the inflation hawks, we may not be giving them enough credit. I mean, I think the viewpoint is much more dangerous than just their cures for inflation, right? Their diagnosis is also a problem. The prescription is obliterate the labor market. We don't want that. But the diagnosis is Americans have it too well off. And that means nothing
right, and
else.
That's driving, and then they're going to want more. And we can't have that.
Right. And these are the same folks who are going to oppose, student debt cancellation, because we can't put another dollar in Americans' pockets because, oh, no, that will increase inflation.
Is a permanent underclass a necessity for American capitalism?
It didn't used to be. I mean, there used to be a lot of rotation.
Well, we were able to change that, weren't we?
No, I mean, that is the single biggest problem with our system at the moment. There's not the mobility. The Horatio Alger story, if that means anything to this generation. You know, it used to be,
Anything to my generation.
No, it used to be. You're born in poverty and you work hard and you're enterprising and you pull yourself up. And that's possible, but it gets harder and harder.
And that's part of the reason that Americans were tolerating such high levels of inequality and such high levels of persistent inequality, was the idea, okay, fine, we're okay with a few rich people as long as everybody has their shot at making it. But over the last few decades, it's become really clear that economic opportunity in this country is highly concentrated. I mean, where the stork drops you in the United States matters, what race you are, where you're born.
By the way, a brilliant economist, but that's not actually how babies... Oh, forget it. We're not...
In the U.S., where some of the world's leading money managers are warning the collapse of another American bank could lead to a credit crunch and an economic slowdown. Constrained lending as a result of stricter banking regulation could stifle credit to the U.S. economy at a critical time. We'll be getting an expert view on this in just a moment, but first, here's my colleague Samira Hussain on the collapse of First Republic.
As of Monday, First Republic customers turning up at their bank are in fact customers of JP Morgan Chase. The signs above will soon change. First Republic had been under pressure since the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank 2 months earlier. Last week, First Republic revealed depositors had withdrawn $100 billion in the space of a few months. Customers feared their money was not safe. Investors became convinced it was about to fail. Riding to the rescue of America's distressed financial system, the boss of America's biggest bank, Jamie Dimon. He says the turbulence in the banks is nearly over.
And so this is getting near the end of it, and hopefully this helps stabilize everything. I think you've seen all the regional banks report. They actually had some pretty good results. The American banking system is extraordinarily sound.
First Republic is the biggest U.S. bank failure since 2008. It invariably brings back memories of the collapse of Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns and the global financial crisis that followed. Industry experts say the causes this time are very different.
It's about two things. It's about the speed with which interest rates had to be hiked and the monetary excess which really preceded it, which is quite different to what happened in, say, 2007.
For the Biden administration, the 11th hour rescue package is a win.
All depositors are protected and the taxpayers are not on the hook. These actions are going to make sure that the banking system is safe and sound, and that includes protecting small businesses across the country.
Despite assurances that the banking system in the United States is safe, three lenders have failed in less than 2 months. And as the U.S. economy seems to teeter towards a slowdown, there are fears here on Wall Street that more banks could fail. Samir Hussein, BBC News, New York.
What kind of job your dad has just doesn't exist anymore.
Why not?
Well, there's no simple answer to that.
All right, see you later.
Bart, come with me to a magical place far in the past. America in the 20th century.
Sure, but you better not start singing.
1945, we won the war. Our boys came back to the factory floor. The good times rolled and smiles were on our faces.
With plentiful jobs for folks of all ages.
Even dumb slobs made excellent wages.
The country was booming,
though still pretty racist.
Oh, and so it came to pass. With hard work and grit and grass. Bit by bit we built our middle class.
I need cash for food and gas. Black like posters, beer and grass. Time for me to join the middle class.
Oh, join the middle class. Come join the middle class.
Well, I'm not smart, I'm not a go-getter. My drinking problem's not getting better. What job could I possibly do?
Nuclear safety inspector.
Woohoo!
Your dad and his buddies had it swell, but gradually it all went to hell. Factories closed, unemployment would spike. Here to explain it is Robert B. Reich.
The decline of unions, rampant corporate greed, Wall Street malfeasance, and the rise of short-sighted politics all contributed to increased economic inequality, widespread real unemployment, wage stagnation, and a lower standard of living for millions of Americans.
They chopped salaries to raise stock prices,
cut up the pie and kept all the slices.
Tax breaks went to CEOs, never trickling down to average Joe. And so it came to pass.
Greedy rich men kicked our ass.
Fiddling while they burned our middle class.
Middle class. All right, thanks for the history lesson, nerds. But what does any of this have to do with me? You see, my dad's still working, and I want to be just like him.
I'm sure you do. But there's something else you need to learn. And my friend here is happy to teach you.
Oh, you. For days, you've been dying to say something. Just spill it.
You want a job like that? Too bad. So sad. You'll never have the life our Flappy Dad had. What can he do that a robot can't?
Hey, Oreos taste like nuclear plants.
Yo, all I need is a foot in the door, and I'll take Dad's job when he does at 44.
That job you see now needs a PhD, while paying student loans leaves you in poverty.
What?
No brand new car. No fancy house. No hot dinners cooked by your stay-at-home spouse.
Yeah.
You're gonna pinch every dollar and cent, and you'll still have to choose between healthcare and rent.
I'll probably just buy a PlayStation 6.
You're naive, but it'll pass. They'll repo your skateboard, you'll grow up fast. He's Jeff Bezos, we're just bozos. Goodbye, middle class. These are facts, they're not controversial. We can't even afford what they sell in this commercial.
Okay, so you're saying maybe I'll have a tough time getting a job like my dad's.
No, I'm saying you'll definitely never get a job like your dad's, and you'll have a tough time finding something significantly worse.
A sitcom needs to be relatable, its characters familiar, as a television series is a commitment of several years of the audience's life. A sitcom often mirrors the lives of the audience, and because of this, the characters are often members of the lower economic classes, waged or salaried workers, laborers, and those performing essential duties while on the low rung of the ladder. Some sitcoms in which classes featured lean in heavily on the social concerns of the lower classes more than the economic concerns, and some barely mention either. The series that do reference economic concerns do so at their own risk, as poverty is not inherently funny. Married with Children was the rare sitcom that frequently referenced the family's poverty, but often blamed the Bundy family's circumstances on the fact that Al married Peg, or on customers making Al's occupation as shoe salesman so painful, or, at least in one case, on a curse. Home Improvement had the flavor of a working-class series, but without the economic concerns. Tim fancied himself a man's man, blue-collar hero, bathed in a romanticized laborer's masculinity while maintaining local celebrity status and a house in the suburbs. The Simpsons only glibly mention the family's occasional economic concerns, often to the point of parody, in which Homer is able to land many different occupations, some of them high-paying, over the course of the series' now infinite run. Some working-class television series have the relatable family patriarch as a police officer, which muddies the waters of class conflict further. Sitcoms balance relatability with aspiration. Characters need to have enough in common with the audience for them to relate to them, but not so much that the audience's stresses and concerns play out with too much familiarity on the television screen. Sitcoms traffic in comedy, and poverty is not funny. And then there's Bob's Burgers, a long-running television comedy in which virtually everything that happens is seen through the lens of the family's ongoing economic concerns. The series stars Bob Belcher, the owner of Bob's Burgers, a fairly unsuccessful burger restaurant, or slop shop, as the children mockingly declare, Linda, the wife of Bob and unpaid worker at the restaurant, and their children, Tina, Jean, and Louise, all three unpaid workers at the restaurant where they work after school. It is unclear exactly how much money Bob makes, the expenses of Bob's Burgers, the expenses of three children, and the cost of the rent in the apartment above the restaurant where they live, but the series makes it clear in almost all of its 194 episodes that the restaurant is not popular, the family is constantly behind on bills, always late on paying the rent, and unable to provide much for their children. While many comedies shy away from this, Bob's Burgers consistently references the family's poverty.
Wow, this is nice. I feel really poor right now.
Yeah.
This is weird. Let's go home, live our lives the best we can. I mean, we're poor, but we're happy. Binders, Lynn. They put them in binders this year. I think we need to explain to them what poor means.
The series actually uses the word poor on a regular basis, anathema in sitcoms. In addition to these references, episodes often center around Bob trying to dig his family out of poverty or trapped in situations caused by their poverty. In Season 1, Episode 6, Bob takes a second job as a cab driver at night while working in the restaurant during the day. In Season 1, Episode 7, Linda turns their cramped apartment into a bed and breakfast. In Season 1, Episode 12, Bob laments that his burger restaurant is struggling because he lives in a seafood town that hails the annual Lobster Fest as its biggest event. The series often references movies that have working-class economic concerns, such as Season 2, Episode 1, which recounts the events of The Goonies, or Season 2, Episode 2, which recounts the events of Dog Day Afternoon. Bob's efforts to increase traffic to his restaurant often blow up in his face, such as in Season 2, Episode 4, in which Bob buys an arcade game that eventually mocks him in his own restaurant. Or in Season 2, Episode 5, in which Bob buys the cheapest vehicle possible to supplement his income with a food truck. These are only a few examples, and only in the first two of the series' 10 seasons so far. In addition, most of the family's rivalries and personal relationships are shaped through class. Tina's primary rival throughout the series is Tammy, a popular girl who transferred to Wagstaff School in Season 2, Episode 8. Tammy is spoiled and is a bad influence on Tina, but the conflict is more that of personality than class until Season 4, Episode 13, in which Tammy refuses to invite Tina to her elaborate and expensive bat mitzvah. Louise convinces the party planner to no longer be Tammy's subject, and Tina steps in, takes over the party, and makes it more fun for everyone, while Tammy is stuck in a giant representation of her own head, towering above the partygoers. The imagery is not subtle. Tammy is, perhaps, not as rich as she believes herself to be, as Season 6, Episode 10 reveals that her parents must have lied to her about Wagstaff being a private school when it is, in fact, a public school. Tina's most notable relationship is with Jimmy Jr., the son of Jimmy Pesto, Bob's most immediate economic rival. Jimmy Pesto is the owner of an Italian restaurant across the street. Bob is simple, honest, and poor, whereas Jimmy Pesto is flashy, dishonest, and successful. Jimmy is not actually Italian, but changed his name to fool his customers about the authenticity of his restaurant. Jimmy is not rich, but his restaurant is successful, placing him in the middle class, or perhaps even upper middle, as a business owner with real paid workers. Jimmy consistently mocks Bob through classist insults about their comparative levels of success and the family's poverty. Bob's Burgers confronts the myth of meritocracy. Many episodes remark on the fact that Bob makes excellent burgers at affordable prices. Season 5, Episode 5 shows how much craft Bob puts into his work, competing for the title of Best Burger. However, Bob is consistently outclassed by Jimmy Pesto, who uses low-quality horse meat, mostly uses frozen food instead of fresh food, and doesn't know nearly as much about food preparation as Bob. Another rival who is shaped through class is Randy, a filmmaker who first threatens to put Bob out of business for serving hamburgers, then rivals Bob with a successful food truck, and is generally a thorn in Bob's side. Randy is a trust fund kid, a fail son of some unexplained fortune.
Mm-hmm. How do you... Oh, right, you're a trust fund kid.
We prefer the term lucky baby duckies.
Yet another antagonist shaped through class is Helen, a woman who inherited wealth when her husband passed away under mysterious circumstances. She's introduced in Season 5, Episode 19, and then reappears in Season 9, Episode 12, in which the children compete with her over a missing valuable. Bob does not maintain many friendships, devoting nearly his entire life to his family and his restaurant. However, his best customer, a working-class laborer named Teddy, forms a bond with Bob which is only sometimes reciprocated. Teddy is a self-employed handyman and Bob is a small business owner with no hired workers. Bob and Teddy don't have much in common, but this shared lifestyle will always mean Bob will have more in common with Teddy than with, say, Randy. Bob's Burgers frequently portrays the police as either incompetent or actively harmful to the communities they are presumably instructed to protect. In Season 1, Episode 5, the police are represented by two officers who pass by the restaurant as it's being robbed, and then fail to go after him when he robs the restaurant again. By Season 2, these officers are gone and the face of the police is Sergeant Bosco. In the aforementioned bank robbery hostage episode, Bosco fires on the bank several times despite the fact that it puts Bob and the other hostages at risk. The robber, Mickey, is not violent but poor. After Mickey is arrested and eventually released, he becomes a friend of the family and later gains employment at the Wonder Wharf. Again, Bob and Mickey have little in common, but their shared class fosters solidarity. Class shapes every relationship in the series. In addition to this, class shapes the episodes, though some are more overt than others. In Season 4, Episode 15, Tina, Jean, Louise, and their friend, regular-sized Rudy, are locked in the back of a train for wine connoisseurs. Unwilling to accept their status as second-class citizens, they plan to rob the train of its chocolate. In Season 6, Episode 11, Tina, Jean, Louise, regular-sized Rudy, and a few others ask to share the bounce castle with the wealthy birthday girl. She rebuffs them, and they seize the bounce castle for themselves. Season 7, Episode 17 revolves around Bob and Linda winning a contest to take part in an elaborate LARP of the show's Downton Abbey proxy. Their roles are assigned at random, and Bob and Linda are given the parts of servants, while other guests are given the parts of the wealthy, a nod to being born into one's economic circumstances. Bob is tempted by the wealthy LARPers into being a class traitor, but he eventually sides with Linda and her revolt against those who were assigned wealth.
Life was horrible back then if you weren't in the super upper class. I'm just glad that we live in a time where there are no classes.
I get what you were going for.
In Season 9, Episode 3, Tina, Jean, and Louise join a school extracurricular in which they create a small business selling wooden figures. Tammy, Jocelyn, and Jimmy Jr. nonchalantly take power and assign themselves the roles of management, doing comparatively little work but gaining far more rewards than labor. Tina initially sides with management until she realizes what this is doing to her siblings and to regular-sized Rudy. When labor recognizes the unfair power dynamics, they fight back, eventually making the small business collectively owned and operated among all workers. These are only a few examples. More than anything else in the series, the class conflict is highlighted most by Mr. Fishoder, the landlord and the richest man in town. Mr. Fishoder is not just the antagonist of one episode, but the primary antagonist of the series, positioning class conflict as an inescapable aspect of every episode of Bob's Burgers, regardless of whether or not Mr. Fishoder appears because the Belchers are always living and always working on their rented property. Rent-seeking is as unjustified as leeching the profits of labor from the workers. A rental property is not simply something someone owns that others want to buy. It is something someone privately owns that the entire community needs to live and that cannot be realistically used only by the owner. The series humanizes Fishoder from time to time, but the belief that rent is exploitation is not a personal jab at individual landlords, but a condemnation of the practice. Whether or not Fishoder is a nice guy is irrelevant, though the series clearly frames him as, at best, aloof, and at worst, uncaring and conniving. In Season 1, Episode 13, Fishoder shows Bob that the games he owns at Wonder Wharf can almost never be won, which is allegorical for the promise of wealth to the lower classes that is historically incredibly difficult to attain. Bob's Burgers highlights the exploitation between landlord and tenant in various episodes in which he has the Belchers perform unusual tasks for him in exchange for leniency on their often late rent. This is not generous on the part of Fishoder. If the Belchers can't pay their rent, they're out on the street. It's an ultimatum that the Belchers must agree to, and Fishoder recognizes this. Class conflict is perhaps the most overt in Season 5, Episode 21, in which Mr. Fishoder threatens to raise the rent on much of the town. Bob organizes a rent strike and marches to Mr. Fishoder's mansion. Fishoder does what those with power and wealth always do: divide the working class against itself. He organizes a water balloon fight, with the winner receiving several months free rent and the losers suffering through the raised rent. The town briefly goes along with it, basically capitalism brain. The idea that instead of organizing to avoid everyone being exploited, some will focus on the extremely unlikely chance of becoming the exploiter. In the end, the town recognizes this, organizes against Mr. Fishoder, and Bob convinces him to keep the rent as is. A small victory. Bob's Burgers has a lot of humanity to it. A lot of talk of the common good. Rarely punching down. Fairly inclusive. And largely avoids the faux edginess that has plagued other animated comedies and has engendered unpleasant fan bases. Faux edginess is not bold. Bob's Burgers is bold because it has the audacity to talk about concerns of the poor in a way that does not shy away from that word, and does not shy away from who maintains economic disparity. That may or may not be the goal of the series or the intention of the writers, but in an attempt to make the series relatable, it has done just that.
Hmm? Marshmallow in the house. Now put a burger in my mouth.
Oh, hey, Marshmallow.
Tall, dark, and handsome.
That settles it. Mom's psychic.
No, she isn't. Marshmallow isn't handsome. She's beautiful.
Blush.
Tomato, potato, Dad.
What's your special power?
I can crack anyone's back. Bob, come here.
All right, just this one.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your brother, Ramirez Diesel Gaia, and this is
Class War Battlefield Podcast episode. It's crazy because this is like the third one that I'm recording in a row just about. You just heard a commercial from Ron DeSantis. Freedom is worth fighting for. Thank you to John Oliver for actually bringing this to my attention. Periodically, I come across these videos that just underscore a problem. That is just so front center that, you know, if you don't recognize what's happening, then it's kind of like, wow, what, are you in denial or something? There is a line in that video where it says, where Ron DeSantis says, decline is a choice. That could feasibly be the modern model of the United States. It's for this purpose that I played following DeSantis's commercial. I played another video titled, Was Age a Sin in 1970? Is it today? Amazing documentary tells it like it is or was. That comes from the documentarian David Hoffman's YouTube page. I found that documentary some time ago, you know, a couple weeks back when he first posted it. And I was intrigued by it. And I was intrigued by it because the fear of death, is very evident throughout the United States. There is this deep, innate fear that has been increasing throughout my lifetime of not only getting older, but moving towards death. And it finally started making sense to me when a couple of things occurred, not necessarily to me, but one of them came from a book that I read, and the other one was more vulgar. So I can't remember what the book title was, but it was an old book. It was from the 1800s, obviously, late 1800s. And it talked about the social gospel, and there was this one Catholic priest who had been kicked out of the Catholic Church for preaching the social gospel, and nobody knew what happened to him. And then the main character of the book found him in a city, working, still wearing his some aspects of his Catholic garb, working amongst the poor, and still preaching the social gospel. And there was this old woman who he was helping maintain her rents, which is kind of what, you know, they used to call it back then, by getting her work that she could do in her home, because she was a little bit infirmed. And when talking to the main character, she said this statement, which was just tragic. She was like, you know, I'm not washed up yet. I may not be able to go as fast as some of these sewing girls, but I still have value. I still have worth. Her value and her worth had become intermingled with what she could do for corporations. And it was clear, looking at her hands, that she probably had rheumatism or arthritis significantly bad, yet she struggled through it to prove that she still had value. That obviously teaches a very important lesson about not only human endeavor and human will, but the desire to be seen as valuable in a society. If she lived in some aspects of Europe prior to the Industrial Revolution, her getting to old age would have been enough to give her value. But because she lived in the United States, and she lived after the Industrial Revolution, her value was tied up to production and manufacturing. The more vulgar example of this came about 10 years ago, maybe a little bit, before then. Might have been in my late 20s. The summer after I graduated from college, I heard an interview with a woman on a alternative media platform discussing an article that she had written about the power dynamics in pornography. It was quite interesting because, I had watched porn and it never occurred to me that there was any sort of power dynamics within porn. Never. And I, might have been innocent, but never. So probably about a year later, I was surfing the internet for pornography. And I came across a video of what was clearly an older woman, probably in her 60s, but maybe not. And she had made a statement to this young man who was going to sleep with her, that she is just like the young girls he's used to. Now, at 60 years old, that seems unlikely. She was well taken care of. It was clear that, she really took care of herself, yada, yada, yada. But during the actual act, she made that statement again. And it's like, okay, maybe she's playing a role. Maybe it's whatever, maybe whatever. But this actually made the guy chuckle a little bit. And he's like, what are you talking about? You're better than the girls that I'm used to because you have experience. And I remember thinking, how terrible it has to be to be a woman in her 60s, and truthfully, not that bad looking of a woman in her 60s. Somebody who has had a couple of children, you could see the scar on her stomach, but yet still had the body of somebody who did not have children. Or maybe, took care of herself after she had children. And yet, to still think that age, there is no use for you. And yet, if you were younger, there would be a use for you. Even as you're getting some. So, again, vulgar, I know. Now, when thinking about these two examples I gave you, the value that each of these women hold within themselves is of property or of what they could be utilized for the gratification of something else. In the first example, the gratification was of those who owned the means of production. In the second example, the more vulgar one, admittedly, as I acknowledged earlier, the gratification of the sexual lust of the young man. Now, of course, some of you might say, well, look, the second one is an extreme example, and it's played up because it's supposed to be, you know, this is something that is put on to titillate you, to kick up your juices. So you really can't use it as an example. But can I? Some years ago, and it wasn't even that long ago, this was a couple of years ago, I was at a local store, quite a well-known one in these areas, and I was shopping because I was about to cook a specific meal. And that's actually important to the story, because I was aiming for specific ingredients when this woman says, oh, you must be a cooker. And I was bending down to grab something, and I stood up and I said, oh, absolutely, you know, I'm cooking something. I forgot what I was cooking, but I mentioned it, and she goes, oh, so you're going to use lamb in there? Yeah, I'm thinking I'm going to use some lamb. And, you know, we started talking, and she kind of walked with me as I went along to get the rest of the stuff that I needed. And I said to her, I said, you know, I'm sorry, but I'm not really making enough for two. And she said, oh, well. And she kind of looked a little down. And I go, well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to, you know, break your heart or anything like that, you know. And she goes, it just, you know, most men turn me down instead of, you know, picking me up. And she goes, when I was younger, I never had that problem. And I go, honey, trust me when I tell you, you're not ugly. You're not ugly. I'm just busy with a lot of things, and adding another woman to, you know, or adding a woman to my life right now isn't feasible. I was, okay, well, I understand. And she was. She was attractive, and I have to imagine probably, because I was in my mid-30s at the time, roughly, she was probably maybe 15 or so years older than me. So, but, I brought up the interaction that I had with her to a female friend of mine, and an older female friend of mine, and she goes, yeah, you know, it gets difficult when you get older, because as a woman, you know, we don't sometimes acknowledge it when we're younger, but yeah, you do kind of like to feel a little sexy, and you like to feel needed and wanted, and you like that look in a guy's eyes that he gives you, and yada, yada, yada. And she goes, and when you get older, you know, you have to settle for what you get, but at the same time, you also don't just want to be a pretty face. You want to be something more than that. And so, you know, that's a little bit difficult. And it got me thinking, especially as I move towards doing this episode, because look, we are, I think, in the stage of development for this for this country, we are in a position now where women are really objects. Now, people will say, well, wait, women have always been objects in this country. And that's very true in many instances. But the objectification that is now occurring is so drastically worse because of the fact that we know the potential that women could reach if they weren't just objects. Now this doesn't just fit with women. There's certain objectification that happens with men too that we often don't talk about, particularly within the capitalist structure and within the division of labor structure. But the reason I'm focusing on women is because it's easier to see. Pornography, and again, this goes back to that conversation that I mentioned earlier. Pornography is an industry that places on full display what capitalism seeks to do to the human body, to render it as something to be utilized and used up. There is nothing sacred within pornography, and I give a lot of praise to not only the woman who wrote that piece that I mentioned earlier, but also to Chris Hedges, who really brought that piece full circle for me. There was quite a bit more that I could say about this topic, but I'm not going to dwell on it, at least not now. I do want to say before moving on, though, thinking about the idea that is expressed in the title of this episode, and I deliberately did that because I wanted to make you think. Value added or value subtracted? What is value? What is value? In the human experience, in the human body, in the human form, what is value? We don't answer that question enough. We don't ask it enough, so we don't answer it enough. But what is value? Again, it goes back to this notion that decline is a choice could be America's model for the last 50 years. Decline is a choice. Here's the thing. There's an elder in the black community, long since, he's become an ancestor. His 30-year passing will be up here in the next 5-6 years. He used to talk about how civilizations go through cycles. Civilizations grow young, vigorous, out there doing their thing. Then they enter middle age, and then they enter old age, and they get tired, and they die. And then something new comes along. Or, and this hasn't happened yet, they have a rebirth. The closest thing to probably a rebirth that we can point to a civilization as having is what the Romans went through. But this is predictable. You can see these stages. The United States is, I think, trying to, if not buck that trend. They believe that they can sidestep it. And so when I hear DeSantis say decline is a choice, that's what I think about. The United States trying to sidestep the idea that it is in decline. The funny thing about this is the policies that DeSantis promotes, the policies that the Republicans promote, as I've said to you many times before, they are nihilarians. These people are nihilists. They look at the government as problematic, particularly the federal government. Heck, they look at state government as problematic. And they have dedicated themselves to tearing apart society. In short, they are engaged in activities that make decline not a choice, but a guarantee. It is not hard to imagine a world where decline in the United States is slowed down by careful, precisionally based decisions. But these people are engaged in activities, actions, and promotions that make decline not inevitable, but encouraged. In another context, some years back, somebody once said to me that the wealthy have a stake in tearing apart societies. Why? Because if we really think of capitalism as being an engine which is promoted forward by competition, that creates a need to go beyond any ceiling that exists. This is why buildings keep getting taller and taller and taller and taller, because somebody's ego has to reach farther than another person's ego. Therefore, if the only thing that capitalism says on an economic level, which, by the way, again, capitalism is both a political and economic system, the economy aspect of it has been widely, widely, widely explored. But I think the political side has not. How does capitalism really fit into Republican reality? From an economic standpoint, you can only get so high. You can become a CEO, an executive as it was, or you could become a person who controls the CEO. Once you get to that point where you can control CEOs, you are also at a point where you can control presidents. But see, if you can control the president, then why can't you just be the president? Now, he told me this after Trump was elected, and some of this I already figured out. But that level, that bit of thinking where it's like, well, if I can control presidents, why don't I just become a president? That hit me like a ton of bricks. And then when I started going back through and re-listening to Death Throes of a Republic by Dan Carlin, Hardcore History, going through, I think it's $10, it might be a little bit more now, Death Throes of a Republic, he literally was giving that away for free. It's one of the most brilliant things ever created about the downfall of the Roman Republic. He's still doing great, marvelous work. You can catch a lot of his work on YouTube. Support him. The guy is an amazing historian. Amazing. Not only just an amazing historian, he tells great stories. Like, there are some historians that could tell you about things and it feels like a slug. Dan Carlin is one of those rare people who can tell you a story and it feels like 3 hours haven't gone by, but 3 hours have sure and gone by. So support his work. So when I listened to that, with that little bit of knowledge that that person gave me, I was able to see some stuff that I wasn't able to see before. And then when I later on found Michael Duncan's brilliant podcast called the History of Rome podcast, man, you want a tour through the Roman history archives? I mean, the only thing that stopped Michael Duncan was what he had access to. What he had access to. If he had had access to more papers, to more historical records, the History of Rome podcast would have went on for significantly longer. But it is a brilliant, brilliant podcast. You can find it on YouTube. You can find it online. The original blog that he put together, where he published amazing information over there for each episode, is still up. Go over there and check it out, the History of Rome podcast. I listened to it once all the way through back the late 2020 into 2021, and started listening to it again late in 2022, and I'm still going right now. It's fantastic. Whether you're drinking it slow or you're drinking it fast. And what I mean by that is the original episodes are between 15 and 25 minutes. And it's funny because some episodes seem like they're longer than that, but they're not. And then, or they might, one or two of them maybe are a little bit longer than that. But they don't, the reason why I say they feel like it's longer than that is because he puts so much information in them that it's like, wow, 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 wow. Wait, how long has it gone by? And this is, okay. So, but then he also went through and put a number of podcasts together in these elongated hour-long, two-hour-long episodes, which are also really good to listen to. So, you know, I'm not getting paid for either one of these plugs, but I love both of the podcasts a lot. So, you know, get out there and check them out. And by the way, the Octavian Wars podcast episode, which I have not yet listened to all the way through, by Dan Carlin. Man, y'all better check into that when it's, whew. Anyway, let me move on because I'll spend another 5 minutes talking about either one of those. So, when I was listening to them, I started seeing certain things that I hadn't seen before. Now, obviously, clearly, I had listened to Death Throes of a Republic before. I hadn't listened to the History of Rome podcast before. But I did. I saw some stuff that was like, oh, maybe America's going down this level. And going down to this level. And going down this pathway. Because that idea of being able to control the power and yet to have the power is something that is ancient. It does go back to Rome. And as I've said before, I really feel like the United States is dedicated to repeating some of the mistakes and problems that Rome did. I mean, when you really go through and listen to the History of Rome podcast, it takes a little bit of time. But especially when you enter into the decline phase and into, you know, the first dozen or more emperors, you start to see some really big through lines to today. Nonetheless, that idea of having the power, even though you could just control the person who has the power, is significant. Because despite what the wealthy did after Franklin Delano Roosevelt died, which was to pass legislation restricting the number of terms a president can run. And not doing the same, by the way, for Congress, because they could buy off Congress a lot better than they could the president. The president is still rather quite powerful. Restricting the president to only two terms, though, limits what they can do. Therefore, it creates instability in a system that really thrives off of instability. Capitalism needs instability to thrive. Now, this is a little bit, you know, this is a little bit funky, because the reality is they had the problem with FDR because FDR moved in a way that was aimed at them. If their guy, who they wanted to replace FDR with, had been the guy who had been elected, they would have, and ran for 3 or 4 terms, they would have never passed that amendment. And look, you know, it doesn't take the most stable genius to figure that out. Now, for some of you, you might say, well, thank God we only have 2 terms because it only stops a person from being in office for 2 terms. Let me tell you what. Let me tell y'all what. Trump literally made the statement, and I know y'all thought he was joking. I didn't. He literally made the statement that he would run again, despite the constitutional hiccups of it, if he won in 2020. He literally talked about that he would run again in 2024. And y'all thought he was joking. Oh, he would never do that. I mean, what gave you any thought that man gave a damn about your traditions? Oh, but it's unheard of. What gave you a 1 minute thought that he gave a damn about what was unheard of? Oh, he would have said FDR did it, and they only made sure he would have pointed it out too, because this is what Trump is really good at. Trump will take truths and he will twist them to the ends that he needs them for. Even though they're evil ends, but he will take truth and he will twist them to the ends that he needs them for. So he would have pointed out what I pointed out. They only stopped FDR because FDR was doing the work of the people. Well, they ain't stopping me. That's what he would have said. And that's why y'all better believe it is dangerous for him to win again in 2024. Because if he wins in 2024, he has no intention of not running again if he's still living in 2028. And I say if he's still living because the man was going kind of crazy by the end of the first term. That stress was getting to him. So, you know. And if it wasn't for those good drugs that he got, he might have got taken out in late 2020, you know, because of COVID. So, you know, if he lives through it. Aside from all that, let's get back to this key point. This fear of getting older. John Taylor Gatto mentioned in one of his last interviews that the vitality in the United States seems to be all gone. It's used up, I think is how he described it. This was back in like 2010, 2011. And that is a key of somebody getting older. Their vitality is lessened significantly. Their vitality is lessened significantly. And look, the reality is the United States doesn't seem to have that innovative mind that it had 60 years ago. We are talking in circles presently about many of the problems that the United States is facing. And that circle isn't a good one. Because for the people who are actually proposing true, pointed, realistic solutions to what is being faced, they ain't the ones producing the circle. The people who are producing the circle are the ones who are yelling vague mottos. This is why Ron DeSantis is right. Decline is a choice. The vague mottos that they have developed over the last 40 years has prevented people from finding real solutions to the problems, to the real problems that they are experiencing. And not only find those solutions, but even before finding those solutions, stopping those problems from getting worse. Sometimes that's the first step. You just got to stop the problem from getting worse. And we're to the point now where even thinking about stopping the problem from getting worse is difficult. A couple of years back, I was talking with an older man, a guy I used to see all the time, and I miss seeing him, man. I used to see all of them down at one of the coffee spots, but COVID kind of shattered that, and this was before COVID, and he was like, you know, I'm 90 years old. I'm like, damn, you don't look it. He's like, yeah, well, that's because I'm big into, you know, staying active, staying fit, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Like, okay, cool. He goes, but you know, it is hard, you know, getting up out of bed some days because I am 90 years old. And I have to continuously be on watch for small problems and take care of those problems before they become bigger. Because at my age, what I may think is a lingering pain, it's kind of there, but it's, you know, it's not important. That could actually be something detrimental if I let it linger too long. So I have to take care of those things constantly. The United States is in the position where it knows it has a lot of lingering pains that it has not addressed for the last 40 years, or it keeps trying to bandage those lingering pains over and cover them up with painkillers. Sooner or later, you keep doing that. The energy and resources that you would have had internally to take care of those problems are going to dwindle. And you're going to find yourself, whether you're talking the United States or you're talking about a human being, you're going to find yourself broken down. And when you really need those resources, that's when what could be and should be an easy fight turns into something that could cost you your life. This is why sometimes you hear of older people dying of like the flu or pneumonia or something like that, because they had a prolonged problem that wasn't getting better, sometimes a prolonged problem that they didn't fix when they could have, and then in comes something that they could easily beat before, but their resources, their body has been so depleted, that's a kill shot. Boom, it's over. And I know it's like, wow, that's brutal. But it's the truth. I've heard older people talk about it like that. So I'm repeating what they're telling me. America was tested with COVID. Yes, COVID took a terrible toll physically. And it took a terrible toll mentally. And it took a terrible toll socially. People have been completely distorted by COVID. And that's something that we have not talked about and we don't talk about as a society. People have been distorted by it. It's changed them significantly. And again, we don't talk about that. But what it also did was it revealed that this country is far, far more vulnerable to being shattered than people thought. Trump did the same thing. This is one of the primary reasons why I am not one of those people running around talking about Russia this, Russia that, Russia this, because the problems, they weren't created by Russia. They weren't even exasperated by Russia. The weaknesses that Russia has been exploiting are only there because what the wealthy have done in this country over the last 50 years have weakened the American body, the American spirit, the American collective mind so thoroughly that what would have been impossible to penetrate before have enough cracks where Russia, China, whoever wants to, can manipulate it. And instead of fixing those problems, the wealthy are making them worse. Decline is a choice. And the wealthy have chosen decline. Another thing that that man told me, which didn't make sense until several years later, is that a lot of these people see themselves as kings. Now, way back in the late 1800s, the early 1900s, people used to talk about the Titans of Wall Street. The Titans were gods, y'all. Some even called them lords of industry. The lords were royalty, y'all. They never called them kings because America don't have kings. But to call a person a titan, to call a person a lord, was literally giving them divine status because most of the lords supposedly are divine. It was huge. Now, obviously, we don't talk like that anymore. Or do we? I mean, we deify entrepreneurship. We deify entrepreneurs. We deify those who have the individualist ethic. So maybe we do actually talk in those terms. We just don't call it those terms anymore because it seems weird. But they want to be kings, he said. And they want rulership over portions of the country. Now, honestly, there was a prophecy that I read some years back that suggested this is true. I won't get into what it said, what it showed, but it suggested it was true. Here's the funky thing about it, y'all. The colonial origins of the United States leaves room for this. The industrial origins of modern America leaves room for this. There were entire towns and counties sometimes that were ran by one person in the United States during the industrial revolution and post-industrial revolution period in the United States. I've talked often about the corporate origins of colonies here on this continent, but what I have not frequently talked about was the massive manors, large plots of lands that were controlled by one or two people in the colonial days of this country. Lords, they were not, because they couldn't be lords. Well, okay, maybe a couple of them were. But most of them couldn't be lords. But they owned huge swaths of land that they really didn't need, but they still owned it. When, for industrial reasons, titans owned whole towns, whole counties, some of them even owned regions, you know, 3-4 counties. They were the law there. They were the law. Nobody told them what to do, not even the federal government, which gets to the point of all of this. One of the reasons all these people are against federal government intervention is because the federal government tells them that they can't do what they just want to do. And a lot of the times what these people did way back when was injurious to the population that lived there, to the people that worked for them, to the community that they owned, essentially, and to the environment. To the environment. I mean, this is why the world's in the shape that it's in today. Decline is a choice. It's about a million of them, but it's made by about 150,000. Those million are made, those million choices are made by 150,000 people. And so the choices add up quickly. Now, sometimes those million choices are actually equivalent to 150 million choices because you got to make them a bunch of times. Or maybe it's 1.3 or 1.5 billion choices because you got to make them, so many times. Some of them more than others. But when you have the capacity to make those choices multiple times a day or multiple times a year, which is more likely, it's every year, maybe you make them two or three times a year. And there's 150,000 of you making them. Maybe actually technically out of that 150,000, it's more like 15,000. But how long do you really think it's going to take 15,000 people to make 1.5 billion decision points if you're making those decisions three or four times or maybe even 10 times a year? It's not going to take as long as you want it to. 15,000 people? Let's say 10 times a year. That's 150,000 choices a year that are negative. On the good end, if you don't make any more choices, you don't add any more to that 10, you're talking about 10,000 years. You're talking about 10,000 years. But if the Industrial Revolution increases, and it's not just now the 15,000 people in this country, but it's 500,000 people around the world making those type of decisions, that 10,000 years is going to erode very quickly, isn't it? Now you have 5 million decisions every year, which is going to take how many years, y'all? 100? 200? 300? 300 years. That'll be 2076, right? Anyway, decline is a choice. Decline is a choice. At the beginning of this show, I play a collage of clips. I actually recently just stumbled upon the original, I didn't even believe I had it anymore, the original collage that I put together. I didn't even think I had it anymore. I found it cleaning out another external hard drive. And one of those clips, and I'm really proud of, like, it's been very difficult for me to think about not using it in the future because I really love this. I mean, it's 10 years old. I made it at the beginning of 2012. And I love it. You know, it really speaks to my heart. One of the clips, though, that I play is from Malcolm X. And it says that America is the only civilization that could be, that is involved in a bloodless revolution. And that really speaks to why I'm doing this episode. It really speaks to why I'm doing this episode. Decline is a choice. Well, it's a lot of choices, but it's a choice. This country is aged right now. In the next 10 years, what happens to this country will be decided by the choices that are made. One of two things is certain. Either the United States will die and whatever is produced after its death is going to be a drastic distortion. By the way, it may take 15 or 20 years technically for this to come into existence. It'll be a grave distortion though of what the United States was and what humanity hoped the United States would become. The U.S. is far onto the path of becoming that distorted equivalent to what humanity hoped it would become. And humanity hopes it would become it because of the United States aspect of it. United States is not just a name, y'all. It's a destiny. So that's the first outcome. It'll die. And whatever replaces it will become a distortion of itself. Or, as Dr. King said, it'll be reborn. Now that rebirth, just like the death of Jesus and the rising of Jesus, the resurrection of Jesus, comes with a feeling of death. I believe we are in the beginning of that feeling of death. But the feeling of death, an actual death, does not have to be the same. This is the problem with most civilizations. They take the opportunity that is presented them for a natural revolution, a nonviolent revolution that is given to every single civilization, and it tosses it aside because it thinks it'll be too painful. It tosses it aside for something worse that is absolutely painful. The death that occurs always is accompanied by real hardcore bloodletting. America has the opportunity not to go through that. The question is, will America choose wisely? Will it decide to allow itself to die? Or will it decide to allow the offer of death to lead to resurrection? Many Christians are praying for death. They want the distorted reality because they believe they're going to be better off in it. Let me shatter that belief for them. Because the ones who are questioning the humanness of God's plan are the ones who want to take advantage of an inhuman world. You have had your say, and you have had your time. We are now in a period of justice. And if you go against the will of God, you will see quickly now the pain that that causes. The United States is offered to be the first in line to choose rebirth. China will be next. Russia will be too. In fact, it may have already failed its test. Earth itself will go through a pattern of death. That's what climate change is. Depending on what her inhabitants, those who have been put here to commune with her, that's us, by the way, do, she will either go to the brink of death and retreat quickly and rebirth herself, or she will be driven beyond the brink of death, and life on this planet will become unsustainable, and all of the children that she had fathered will go away. Those who can stay will stay, but most will go away. And then she will wait a few million years and be inhabited again. The choices are ours. Decline is a choice. The choices are ours. For the first time, and this is the last thing I'm going to say before I end this. For the first time in human history, the power is being taken from the hands of the few and being put in the hands of the many. The gods have finally learned their greatest lesson. The people who have elevated themselves to the top of society are not the ones who hold the truest truth. And so we are now being called to do the great divine will. We are being called to do the great divine will. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can always reach out to me. I am your brother, Brian Mary Diesel Gaia. If you can, support my work, CWB Podcast, CWB Podcast, CWB Podcast. Cash App, $ in front of it. PayPal, CWB Podcast, 2, 5, 10, 20, 50. Whatever you can do, make it monthly. Help me reach my goal of not only being able to do this full time, but to share the love. I would love to be able to act as a conduit, give to various blogs and podcasts. I've talked about this before. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can always reach out to me. Radio, the number 4, all.net. You can reach out to me there. You can find new episodes there. I've been publishing quite a bit. I don't expect that to slow down for the foreseeable future, but you can reach out to me there. You can also find me on anchor.fm or on Stitcher. Again, I'm your brother, Ryan Mary Deese. Oh, God, yeah. Until the next one, y'all. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places.
where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and there are lies in the balance.